At 3:04, and today is Thursday, February 27th. We have today in attendance Representative Heron, Representative Miller, Representative Seaton, Representative Dick, Representative Millett, and Representative Sista, and myself, chairing Representative Keller. What we're doing today is we're getting a overview of the Department of Health and Social Services, a nice $2 billion budget organization here that we want to get the best overall 100% view of what the department is. Both, I always look forward to the review, even though I've heard it before. We have some new members. And the intent is to go slow and to, make sure that we get dialogue and questions answered. We haven't come up with any specific questions that we would have got them to you before this. If we get toward the end, we'll gavel out at 5, and if we get to the end and it looks like we're clearly going to have more, we'll extend on next Tuesday, and we'll just kind of play it as we go. And I will let you guide us as far as whether or not you want to make an entire block presentation of parts of it before you take questions. Please let me know. Otherwise, committee, catch my attention, and we can ask questions, whatever, we'll just, but if you would rather present the information as a package and then go for the questions, any part of it, let me know on that. I would appreciate it. So to get started today, I will call up Acting Commissioner Bill Struer, and we're at your mercy. We are going to respond to your guidance as you make this presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Struer, Acting Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. Seemed like only last week we were here. With me is Allison Elgee. Allison will be presenting the second portion of the presentation today. What we'd like to do is a walkthrough of the department for you. This is the overview. This is the 10,000-foot level. We won't get into a whole lot of budget detail. As far as questions go, we welcome questions that, interspersed through the presentation as they come to mind. And with that, I'd like to begin. We have all our directors here today, and from time to time we'll be bringing them up as their various sections, divisions come up. And we'll be introducing them as we go. I'd like to begin talking about the mission, vision, and department priorities, if that's all right. The mission of the of the department remains to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. Our vision: all individuals and families are healthy, safe, and productive. Major priorities, beginning with substance abuse and mental health services. I don't think there's a person in this room, I don't think there's a person in this building that's not affected in some way by substance abuse and mental health issues. Whether it's family, whether it's friends, whether it's associates, whether it's those we work with, it is the most pervasive presenting issue that we deal with. Major strategies within substance abuse and mental health services include prevention and health promotion, early intervention, treatment services, and recovery. Those familiar with particularly substance abuse, we know it's a lifelong it is a lifelong process to recovery. Earlier presentation that I did, a friend of mine always talked about the further he was from his last drink, the closer he was to his next drink. And that's a basic tenet of most people I know in recovery. And speaking to just that portion of this particular item shows the significance of what it is we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. It is a significant issue in the state of Alaska, both substance abuse and mental health issues. Health and wellness, we need to focus on getting people well and keeping them well. Major strategies include prevention and health promotion. I've spoken, I think, with most of the people in the room, and we've touched on various parts of what that entails. It might be vitamin D therapy. It might be prevention programs in the schools. It might be early periodic screening, diagnosis, treatment of children. But it's a huge part of what we do and continue to do. Disease control, access to care. One of the things that we focus on, particularly with the Medicaid program, is getting the right care in the right places. We spend $70 million a year. You'll hear this in the details of the budget later. We spend $70 million a year on transportation, and it says that we could probably do a better job with right place, right care for individuals, particularly in our rural and bush communities. Emergency response and preparedness, we continue to work on developing and enhancing that. Throughout the process, you'll hear about our trauma efforts. Last year, this body passed a trauma bill to begin to promote trauma centers being located in the hospitals throughout the state. And environmental health impacts. We're facing those on a daily basis. We'll continue to face those. We need to gear up to prevent those as well as cure those. Healthcare access and delivery. Major strategies include technology for sustainable and effective healthcare delivery. You've heard me speak about the new Medicaid Management Information System in previous years. That's a system that we believe that we are on a fast track now to go live on in early spring of 2012, which will allow us electronic capability for all claiming processes as well as up-to-date data warehouses that can give us information without having to write programs start over. Right now we're operating with a 27-year-old non-relational database system, paying claims very well, but every time I want to get something out of that data bank, it's not an easy process. Tied to that is health information exchange and electronic health record. Beginning in the spring of this year, we will begin offering the incentive grants to providers to develop electronic health records, and it will be a significant effort working with providers to allow us to be connected electronically and be able to transmit data back and forth. There's nothing I'd like better than for someone in YK flying into Anchorage for care, being able to have his full record brought electronically to ANMC or whatever treatment center he may, or every hospital he may be going to. The health information exchange is still in the developmental process. It's still a vision. It's beginning to unfold. We have a partner in developing that, the Alaska Health Network, and they are working as deliberately as they possibly can to bring this up. But we have to have electronic health records to be able to tie into the health information exchange. So I think that's going to be the big determinant and challenge for us.
Yes, Chair.
Or Representative Seaton, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been some consternation expressed to me by providers that that had gone to electronic health records and that they're going to have to dump their system and go with a new system. Does the system that the state's looking at, is that a unified system, and are there ways to correlate existing systems into that, or is it all going to have to be done again from scratch?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's a maybe question. Those that purchased a system several years ago that do not have the current technology, they may be faced with having to upgrade their system. The nice thing about the health information exchange is that it works with a variety of systems, and basically the data comes into the health information exchange. They decode that data so that they can transmit it to the receiving agency, and I believe that we're going to have much fewer issues around providers having to purchase new systems than what I think was initially feared.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One follow-up on that. I think I heard you say that the state that's farthest ahead in this process, only 18% of the providers were signed in. Maybe I heard you wrong, but my point really is, or that I'd like you to respond to, is we're a long ways from it. I mean, I think everybody in this room has been accumulating paper records for a few years, you know, and it's going to take a long time for this to actually be in a place in operation 100%, as I understand it. Yeah, it's exciting, but we got a long ways to go on this, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. It's going to take a long time to turn the barge of paper records. The state of Massachusetts has been at it for several years. They're only 18% connected. The first thing is to entice providers to convert to electronic health records. The second thing is to entice them to see the value of participating with the health information exchange. So we have two challenges there. I think that the federal largesse in offering rather significant contribution to a provider's ability to develop electronic health record in a similar amount to the states to develop health information exchange is going to speed the process, but it's still going to be a long road.
Thank you.
Workforce development. We hear about it every day. We need more experts in the field. I don't think that's going to change, but I don't think that we can lose touch with the advancements that we've already made in the bush in developing allied health extenders, if you will, for healthcare to ensure that basic services are there so that we begin to and help people get involved in the process. If you haven't been onto a village clinic yet, you need to do that and see the great strides and the great service that they provide in the villages. It's a wonderful effort, but we need to continue to develop it. We need to have the physicians, we need to have the psychiatrists, we need to have the nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, the nurses, keep on going down the line because we need them all.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And what Acting Commissioner or Commissioner Stewart, that I agree, and I think 7 or 8 years ago I went to my first village clinic, and the changes that I've seen have been amazing. But at the health summit about 7-6 years ago, they were talking about the problem that they had with telemedicine and the inability to actually create a system where they could bill. Because they're working right alongside the workers that are charging, and how are you going to bill for the telemedicine machine, whatever that little system is called. It is absolutely true that what I have seen is that 7 years ago, the community health aides were having a devil of a time trying to use them at all. And now they're used for all kinds of different telemedicine, and they're even in really remote places used for training. But that issue of the ability to actually have them be able to get paid for so that, in fact, communities can keep them, that's one. Do you deal with that? Are you working on that one?
Representative Sisson, through the chair, yes, we are.
Okay.
I've been working with Stuart Ferguson from ANTHC, API, and others involved in the telemedicine efforts. The big challenge was that the receiving provider was able to bill for the service, but the sending provider is not able to bill for the service. So we might have an RN sitting at a table in Kotzebue talking to a physician in Anchorage, and only one of them could bill. Wasn't right. So we are redoing our technology, not our technology, we're redoing the regulations to be able to accommodate both sides of that. Because the studies show that 40% of all transportation is avoided by having effective telemedicine programs. And when you look at $70 million, I look at $28 million as being 40% of that. If I can save half of that, I'm going to be one happy camper, so very, very definitely. It was a challenge, continues to be a challenge, but I think we're on the right road for it to unfold in the very near future.
A dumb question on that, if I may follow up again. Does MMIS, the new system that's coming up, will that have any parts of it that are part of, will that change any of the billing processes, electronic billing processes, or is it completely a different system?
Representative Keller, Chairman Keller, there would be very little change that the provider sees with the new MMIS system coming up. What they are going to see is they'll be able to do electronic lookup of their claims, where their claims are in the process. And we have, for a rural state with supposedly limited access, we have a very high percentage. We have over 78% of our claims coming in electronically. That's pretty good.
Okay. We've interrupted you, but back to the workforce development. What is the department doing as far as just recruiting? And I mean, is there anything new going on, improving the climate to attract a bigger workforce? Or, I mean, just in general, if you would, to get you back on track here a little bit? Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, we continue to work with the university, other departments, in coming up with workforce strategies that to both entice and retain the skilled workforce that we need in the state of Alaska. We're one of the few states that, as some say, that has very few incentives to providers to, whether it be through loan repayment, loan forgiveness, or other programs. And I understand that there's quite an effort here in the legislature, that at least this time around, to continue to bring that program forward. But I think the real effort has to be creating an environment that providers want to stay. And I think that's where we work with the university and the other departments in making a better place to work. So, does that help, sir?
Yeah, thank you.
Enhanced management of high health needs. You've heard the saying that 15% of the population consumes 75% or 85% of the healthcare dollar. That's not totally unchanged here. I think we're closer to probably 75% or 70% with that 15%, but still a significant portion that we need to do a better job on management of. And we haven't identified those strategies yet, but the famous Medicaid Task Force that you all hear about, some of you are members on, we are going to present some options in that area to begin to manage that. Sustainable long-term care delivery system, identification of, and coordination of health and welfare needs. We need to look at the whole person and all of their needs. We not only have to give them a place to get their health care, we need to give them tools and opportunities to be able to sustain a healthy lifestyle and healthy environment, whether it be their homes, whether it be heat, whether it be safe water, no matter what it may be. We need to promote a service array that meets the needs of underserved who require long-term care services. We need to develop an integrated, comprehensive model of care. Those of you that were on the committee last year heard me moan time and again about not knowing if we're spending $1.5 million in Medicaid, $1.5 billion in Medicaid, and I don't know if it's the right care, the right time, the right place, to the right people. And we need to do a better job with that to make sure that we are indeed doing that and providing that. The final priority that I want to touch on is vulnerable Alaskans. We need to protect and care for our population. We need to have protective services for both children and our elders, caring for them, making sure that the care they're receiving is appropriate, making sure that they're not taking advantage of. We need to promote domestic violence and sexual assault programs. I've gotten a very clear message that it is a big priority here in the state, and I believe it needs to be a big priority in the state. We're working with public safety, law, and corrections to develop a sustainable, effective program for domestic violence and sexual assault. Suicide prevention. I don't think there's a person in here that is not touched by that in one way or another, either by someone close or in our village or in our town. And our suicide prevention programs need to continue to grow and be promoted and be effective. Bring the Kids Home Initiative. Yesterday, or a couple of days ago, when I did a presentation, I made the mistake of saying that there's 128 people or 128 kids out of state. It was cited to me on numerous occasions since then as 90. I'm doing much better than that. and I had old information. So we have 90 kids that are out of state. At one time, we had 400 plus. And that's a significant effort by our behavioral health people to indeed bring the kids home. Next step of bringing the kids home is keeping the kids home. And in this case, it's home in their village, home in their town, home in their wherever they may be. And that's going to be developing an array of services to be able to support good lifestyle.
Representative Sisson?
Thank you very much. At one point, I remember there being a record of that was being kept, where you could actually go to a site and keep track of who was in state custody, who was out of, who was there, the list of the people that were out of state. And I don't remember there being anything about placement in institutions versus those who were in community-based programs. But we need to have that so that we can track exactly what progress we're making in that. Really know that we're getting kids out of institutions, not just in some other state, but in our state and out of institutional care, because those are sort of similar elements. And do you know of any website that might have that in the state, or is it possible that that can be done?
Through the chair, Representative Sisson, off the top of my head, I do not know of a website on that, but we can get information. Melissa Stone is here. She'll be up at the table sometime in the next few hours. And so that's a good question to pose to her.
Good. All right. We'll do.
Again, if I could, a follow-up on that. As I understand it, it's just partly for clarification because it didn't dawn on me right away. And maybe our goal isn't zero. In other words, it's what do you say, 93? And the reason is because there are simply some that we cannot address in Alaska because of our population and resource base. We just don't have it. So I don't know what the ideal goal is, but I mean, it's just phenomenal, the success in the program. And it isn't that we have arrived, and I'm glad to hear the next step is keeping them home rather than getting to zero. But thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, on that topic, how has the Fairbanks home, has it increased its bed size with some of those children coming back?
Representative Heron, through the chair, I don't have that answer right now. That's another one that Melissa is going to have to handle. And we'll make sure that we get that to you. But they are, I don't think that they're up to full capacity, but they have definitely gotten through many of the challenges that they had from about a year ago. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at the end of his presentation, I have a general question for the commissioner.
Okay. Thank you. Proceed.
Finally, on the Vulnerable Alaskans Family First program, to expand the program was designed to help families leave the public assistance roles and find employment through coordination of services between state agencies to assure that designs and services meet family needs versus individual program requirements. In other words, design what we do around the family rather than around the convenience of the program. And that is a quick overview of our
On Family First. I've always been enamored and appreciated the emphasis as I see it. Probably isn't as it's more broad and not entirely accurate, but I see it as with an emphasis coming from the department toward individual and family responsibility and engagement, community engagement. And there were several examples of what the department did that I thought was fantastic, and I'm delighted that that is continuing. And just wanted to say that it was great. Family First to me stands for something that is a proper prioritizing by the department that I've always appreciated, and just wanted to say that in a positive sense.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that comment. Now what I'd like to do is begin a little run-through of the department. I'm just going to begin the early phases of it, and then I'm going to turn it over to Allison. But as you can see, we're a fairly large department. We have myself presently sitting as acting commissioner. Chief Medical Officer is Ward Hurlbut, sitting right back here. I think all of you have met him, acting. I am the, as well, the Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy, Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services, Pat Hethley, back there as well. And then sitting next to me, was on my right yesterday, Assistant Commissioner for Finance Management Services, Allison Ilgey. And the department is rather broad focus. It's called super agency at the national level because we have both health and social services. We have eight divisions that we will go through beginning today. We have 3,690 employees. We have a combined budget of $2.445 billion. Next slide, please. The breakdown of that money, you can see that there's no little divisions in the department. I was sitting with another commissioner a while back and talking about our deficit that we have, and he looked at me and he said, "Your deficit's bigger than my whole department." And so it was kind of a shock and for me, but $2.445 billion, as I said, with the 800-pound gorilla being one that you're probably going to spend a lot of time on, $1.5 billion for Medicaid. And with that, Representative Heron, I think, had a question.
Mr. Chairman, though the information is about 30 days old, could you brag a little bit about your performance bonus that you got from the feds?
Through the chair, Representative Heron. We received a $4.4 million performance bonus from the federal government for our Denali Kid Care program. No strings attached, except we can't use this match against federal dollars. Otherwise, we can spend it as we will. And I'm sure you will all have some input into that decision. But it's last year it was $700,000 that we received. And when we got some early indications, it was they said in excess of $1 million. And when I saw the final number, I was very surprised at CMS and received a first personal phone call about that. So it was wonderful to receive. So thank you very much for being Allison.
Before we start, Allison, I just wanted to say before we proceed, just a comment that we're very appreciative that this big operation called Department of Health and Social Services, that your top folks are here today. We know it's a big investment for you, and we want to make the best of it. And I just wanted to say at this point, because Allison is going to introduce the different various directors as they come up, but I just wanted to say before you come up, thank you for being here, and you know, we'll try to make the best of the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm Allison Ilgey, Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management Services. Before we start our division-by-division overview, I wanted to just bring to your attention a couple of documents that have been distributed to each of your offices. These would have arrived late last week, and I think that you will find them quite useful in your work with the department. The first is the fiscal year 2012 budget overview document. This is one that we will be working with and from as we go through our different budget requests with the House Finance Budget Subcommittee. And I know a number of you are participating in that effort. But all of you should have received this document. There is a wealth of information in here about our division activities, performance measures and outcomes, as well as our budget requests for this upcoming year. In addition, you also should have received the fiscal year 2011 operating grants book. This book has a wealth of information about the variety of grant programs that we oversee throughout the state. It is going to, as you go through here, you'll find information that is by grant program, and then at the end of the book, the grants are also listed by election district.
All
on that on a question on that. I think it's very important. As I understand your review, this little booklet here that reviews the grants, I think that represents two or three line items in the major budget. Am I right? So this is kind of a drilling down to see exactly where the grant money is going in any particular area like behavioral health.
Thank you for that
took
clarification,
me a while to...
Mr. Chairman. We distribute over $160 million in grants and through all of our different division programs.
Reverend Sister.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to ask, is there in that booklet any reference to former grant levels and kind of how we are in the state in terms of where monies are going, and are we declining or increasing in terms of the numbers of dollars that we're spending in grant monies to communities?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, this particular document does not provide you that, although we do publish it every single year. So we can do an year-to-year comparison for you if you have specific interest in a program area. Just in general, our budget has been relatively steady in terms of the dollars that we have available for grants, but we what you may see is a redistribution of some of those dollars amongst the grantees themselves.
Follow-up purposes.
Thank you very much, and that just makes me think. To have some comparison with the grant monies and where we're stacking up nationwide in some of the problems that we face, where we're leading or hopefully we're coming down in terms of the severity of some of the problems that we have had in the history of the state is real important in this committee and in the Finance Subcommittee. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, our first division is that we're going to discuss today is the Alaska Pioneer Home Program. Dave Cody is the director of the division, and he's going to be joining me here at the table. Our Pioneer Home Program employs 557 full-time people and 43 part-time people. One of the things that I like to point out to folks as they look at these numbers, because frankly the numbers appear staggering, is that in a 24-hour institutional environment that's operated 7 days a week, we're running essentially three shifts every day, and then because we work our employees 37 and a half hour weeks, we pick up extra shifts on the weekend. So in order to get an actual idea of how many people we've got providing care to residents at any given time, you need to take the number of authorized physicians and essentially divide by five. And that gives you a much closer coverage ratio for the operations of the Pioneer Homes. The coverage ratio is going to be different depending on the program that we're talking about, but in any 24/7 environment, you're going to see a similar kind of overstatement of staff, if you will, relative to what we're actually capable of doing. We have in the Pioneer Homes 508 licensed assisted living beds. We operate five Pioneer Homes and one State Veterans and Pioneer Home in Palmer. The six homes are located in Sitka, Ketchikan, and Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and then, as I said, the Veterans Home in Palmer. We use an approach for admission to the Pioneer Homes that is kind of two-tiered. First of all, in order to be eligible for admission, you have to be at least 65 years of age and have been a resident of Alaska for the year prior to seeking admission. And then we maintain two different wait lists. So we have an inactive wait list for people who would be eligible for admission but don't really want to go to the Pioneer Home tomorrow. They just think at some point they may want to go into a Pioneer Home. And essentially that preserves your place in line. If you decide to sign up for the inactive wait list, the only thing that you will be asked to do is on an annual basis essentially recertify your interest in maintaining that place on the list. Once you decide that you are interested in actually going into a Pioneer Home, you contact the Pioneer Home Program to convert your application from the inactive list to the active wait list. In December, we had over 500 people on the active wait list against, like I said, 508 available beds. This means that people can sit on that active wait list even after they indicate an interest for quite some while. In some cases, it can be as much as 2 years before a bed will open up. And it's a caution that we try to give people interested in Pioneer Home admission, because most frequently what you'll find is that people don't actually activate their application until they are in dire straits. And it's a difficult situation for the families. We charge fees for our Pioneer Homes ranging from $2,135 a month to $6,170 a month, depending on the level of service that the Pioneer Home applicant needs upon admission. And we have beds designated for those different levels of service. So it's another criteria that we have to look at as we work the active wait list. We've got an appropriate bed based on the service need of the individual applicant and gender. The only place where we don't follow exactly the date of the active wait list application is in Palmer, where we have an obligation under our federal licensing requirements to build up the population of veterans. So veterans do get a preference in that, and I'm sure if people want the exact details, Dave can go into them in a bit. We, in the way that we charge for the Pioneer Homes, we do not ask for any kind of financial information at admission. It is not a criteria about whether or not you can come into the Pioneer Homes. But if you get into the Pioneer Homes and are unable to pay the bill, we work with the individual and the family members to determine what kind of alternate payment sources might be available. We do use Medicaid waiver revenue for those people who are eligible for Medicaid waivers. And the veterans provide assistance for veterans in the homes, and then there is a payment assistance program that is state-funded for those individuals who are not able to fully make the monthly bill. We're really experiencing, besides just the demand for Pioneer Home beds, two significant issues that are impacting our delivery of care. We've seen over the last several years a real increase in the acuity level of residents in the Pioneer Homes. Pioneer Homes specialize in dementia care, but and what we're seeing in terms of the acuity of those residents, back in 1995, we had 63% of all of our residents that needed the highest level of care that we offered. Today, we are meeting that same level of care for 88% of the residents in the home. This has staffing implications, and it's something that is that we constantly struggle with, to maintain the kind of staffing needed to assure the care and safety of the residents in the homes. The other issue that is becoming increasingly problematic for the Pioneer Homes is that as a result of people's progressive dementia, you will get a resident who will go through a period that where their behaviors are can be assaultive. We get very difficult behaviors sometimes manifesting in these residents, and we have to make sure that we're protecting not only the individual exhibiting the behaviors, but also the other residents in the home. And sometimes that can require one-on-one staffing, and we don't have the staffing complement to be able to afford that. It becomes quite difficult because alternative placements for these individuals are difficult to come by. So Mr. with that introduction, I'm going to...
Representative Aaron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that. So essentially, it's one employee per resident?
Through the chair, Representative
approximately,
Aaron,
yeah.
In terms of the total staffing that are authorized for the homes, yes. But again, you never have that one-on-one staffing because the complement is really, when you look at a coverage ratio, more along the lines of 120 staff throughout the homes because of the 24/7 coverage.
Okay. Yes. And so, of course, your continuing challenge is, that you said is dementia-related. So has, Mr. Cody, have you figured out how to a transition for those people that are suffering from dementia into other facilities, so there's not quite the demand that you have now? Or
before you answer that, Dave, if you would, just and I don't want to lose this, it's a very good question, but could you give us some kind of an idea about the other beds that are available in the state? Pioneer is just part of the picture as far as take, you know, care. I mean, how many? And then then Bob's would be a really great follow-up question. But what do you call them? Nursing beds, and how many? And assisted living, of course, is out there. Just a little description on that.
Mr. Chairman, in our long-term care continuum right now, we have slightly over 700 nursing home beds available throughout the state. And we have approximately 3,500 individuals on long-term care waivers of one kind or another. Now, not all of those individuals are going to be in assisted living homes. Some of them are receiving services in their home. But the assisted living portion of that is certainly key in terms of being able to provide home and community-based services.
Okay, thanks. The reason I asked that first, Representative Herron, is that I'd like to expand your question just a little bit, too, you know, and that is what's being done as far as coordinating the different types of care that's available as we see the acuity increase in the Pioneer Home. How does that fit in with the nursing home beds? I just don't have a good picture of it.
Mr. Chairman, we are assisted living. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Dave Cody, the director of the Alaska Pioneer Homes.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, when they need nursing home level of care, they need to move to a nursing home. Basically, we can provide excellent care even at level 3, but we don't provide ventilator, IV, or tube feeding, things of that nature. You have to go to nursing home for.
Clarify that for us. It may not be up on level 3. What a nursing home then is what, considered level 4? And I don't know.
In the Pioneer Homes, Mr. Chairman, in the Pioneer Homes, we have 3 levels. Level 1 is the lowest, and it's the, right. the lowest amount that we charge, and level 3 is our highest. Level 3 people need 24-hour care, 7 days a week, and are oftentimes look pretty much what a nursing home level would look like, although we are not licensed as such.
I see. Thanks. It helps.
Just a quick follow-up. I don't want to delay the overall presentation, but you know, looking at last year's reports that you have given us, is has your medication error rate continued to decrease, and has your Medicaid administered rate increased as from last year?
Representative Herron, through the chair, I would say that our medication error rate has stayed about stable. It's about the same. And if I understand the second part of your question, you're asking how many Medicaid waiver recipients we have?
No, your medication, the medications that you give to the residents, has that continued to rise compared to over the,
you know? Our volume of medications is very high. It's it's like about 550,000 a quarter, so about, you know, probably 2 million doses of medication annually.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few years ago, there was the veterans prescription and the bubble packing and all that. Has that been all solved, and is that all taken care of so that that issue hasn't arisen anymore, or that's completely solved? Is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, we have resolved. We've worked with the VA to get, basically, we're taking the VA meds. We're not putting them in blister packs. We're administering them directly from bottle. And the difference between a veteran who chooses to get their medications through the VA and somebody who gets them from our pharmacy is our pharmacy puts them in blister packs. And certified nurse aides can administer them, while we choose to have a higher level of safety by having only nurses administer the VA drugs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if there are no additional questions regarding the Pioneer Home Program, we're going to move on to the Division of Behavioral Health. And folks are going to stay in the audience, so if there are questions that occur to you as we go along, we can always bring them back up.
Thank you. And Allison, if are all of your the people here based in Juneau, if something gets put off, you may want to consider the travel costs. And if we have to wait till Tuesday on something, your call.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that opportunity, although I think pretty much everybody was already planning on being in town next week as well for other meetings.
Thank you.
Okay, the Division of Behavioral Health employs 334 full-time folks, 11 part-time folks. The bulk of these people are located at API. We have 240 employees, full-time employees authorized at API and 9 part-time employees at API. And again, this is another 24/7 operating environment. So these folks work around the clock 7 days a week in order to provide service. What that means then is for the rest of the work of the Division of Behavioral Health, we really have something less than 90 people to carry out. Most of the work that we do through the Division of Behavioral Health, we do through in partnership with communities and nonprofit agencies throughout the state through grant programs that the Division of Behavioral Health administers. In fiscal year 10, we had reported individuals receiving behavioral health services almost 19,000 people. Over the past 3 years, we've incorporated program performance standards into our grant review process. And as I stated in earlier this week in the committee that we've previously made this presentation, the Division of Behavioral Health has been a leader in the department in terms of implementing this conversion to expected outcomes as opposed to just reported outputs in our grant environment. And for if people have additional questions, we've got our expert right here in Melissa. The division staff provide technical assistance to these providers throughout the state, and it is no small task given our geographic diversity to actually be able to meet the needs of all of those grantees. Underneath the Division of Behavioral Health for administrative purposes, you will also find the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Alcohol and Substance Abuse Advisory Board, and the Suicide Prevention Council. I've already really highlighted the difficulties that we have in this division, and that is the ability to provide services throughout the state at the levels needed. We have both, workforce issues as well at the state level, as well as at the community level, in terms of trying to provide good quality care. And we end up seeing, as a result sometimes of not having the full community infrastructure throughout the state, we have people end up referred to API, where alternative treatments, were they available at the community level, would be more appropriate. So we struggle with that continuum of care need.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton, and then Representative Hare.
Thank you. Previously, we had a problem with mandatory overtime and staffing and problems at API. What's the situation now there, and what is the nurse and other practitioner's satisfaction with the situation?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we are in the process right now of preparing our first reports under the legislation passed by you folks last year, House Bill 50, that set some parameters around the use of mandatory overtime and some limits on how long you would work a nurse in any environment. API is subject to that legislation, as is the Pioneer Homes, and we are pulling that information together right now. Our first reports to the Department of Labor are due in February. But we work really hard to minimize mandatory overtime. And I do want to differentiate for the committee the use of mandatory overtime, which is kind of the last-minute situation where somebody is asked to work overtime that they had not planned, versus scheduled overtime. We will always have some scheduled overtime, and the employees participate in developing those schedules.
Follow up. You know, part of the real discussion around the overtime was the continuation and the safety factor and the problem whether it was mandatory or voluntary. If you work 24 hours in a row or 20 hours in a row, the chances of making mistakes become much elevated. So although we're talking mandatory overtime, I would like to does that report come to us? And I would like to also find out where we build in that safety margin and how much, even where it's being scheduled as overtime, how much are we considering, you know, patient safety?
Thank you, Representative Seaton. And you're correct that there are limitations contained in that legislation where it doesn't matter how the overtime was arrived at, but we should not be working nurses more than 14 hours a day in accordance with that legislation. And that is to meet the safety requirements that you're alluding to.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Heron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. No question. I just want to take the opportunity during this part of the overview, and then we'll revisit it in the Finance Subcommittee. But thank you for your support on the Sobering Center in Bethel.
Representative Sisson.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there's a couple things that I'd like to ask, I really do appreciate the ongoing effort that your division really has been working on, trying to increase the behavioral health people that are out there in the communities. And it's in some of the communities that I've visited, it's really neat seeing how people are progressing from being the community health aide with they get a lot of experience, but minimal amount of training. And then some of the people that I've met have moved on to getting their master's degrees. And it's really neat knowing that out in the middle of nowhere, people are connecting with the university and working through state programs and actually doing that. And it's really a success story. But I heard something, I hate to say this, but last month, actually, that in some of these programs, they go through all of the steps. They go through the internship process. And then when they're through with everything, the jobs that might result don't come through. And I think that's something that we need to be working with the educational university or what other program that might be there to make sure that when we've got people training for that, that we actually are coming through with the potential work that, and they're from a community, they're not going to easily be moved, and that's not even the idea. We want to grow our own, right, in each place in the state. So if you could look into that, I think that would be a really helpful thing, and I might be able to give you some contact numbers.
Representative, through the chair, I'd be glad to follow up. I haven't heard of that specifically,
okay.
And it might be specific to a specific area. I don't know, but I'd be glad to follow up.
There's actually several that I know of. Yeah, thank you.
And Representative Heron, through the chair, we currently have a CON for 60 beds at Boys and Girls Home. I understand that as of this week, 56 of those beds were full. And you had asked about the levels. There are 44 at level 5, 16 at level 3.
Wow. Outstanding, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. I apologize. For the record, Melissa Stone.
Mr. Chairman, outstanding, because per the request of Representative Coghill at the time, but now Senator Coghill, we went and traveled to that community, and that's great news.
Now, for the record, that was Representative Herron, and we need, I'm trying to clean up our act. It is my fault, and you know, thank you for not reminding you. API, that does both inpatient, outpatient, and how many beds? Is it, or does it? I mean, help me.
It only does inpatient care.
Only.
It has, it's licensed for 80 beds, and we've been running at capacity.
Thank you. Any other questions, please proceed. Or did I miss? I'm sorry.
I just had a last thought. We are working at capacity. If you were to expand it all, say, to 120 beds, do you believe those 120 would be full?
Representative Dick, through the chair, you know, they, as they say, if you build it, they will come. I think that there's always a danger at whatever level of service that if you build a service, you'll find a need for that service. What we're really working to do is to see what whether beds are being used appropriately, whether admissions are appropriate. We are looking at our interfaces with the courts, with judges, with local hospitals, community provider agencies. So before we would look at any kind of expansion, we're really looking at, is our system working as efficiently and effectively as possible?
Yeah, thank you. I'm not at all familiar with the situation now, but I know 10 years ago there was I know there was a lot of pain in terms of people needing service and not being available. So maybe at some other time, maybe you and I can get together, and I'd like to catch up with what the improvements that have been made.
That was Representative Dick, for the record, and Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few years ago, when I was on this committee, we were looking at the program that allowed for a intermediate stay, say from Southeast, so that it could be at the hospitals. I can't remember the classification of the hospitals. Is that program still going, and how effective has that been, and are there any problems that we need to address to make that more effective?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, you're talking about the designated emergency stabilization and designated emergency treatment option that we have throughout the state. And we, recognizing that this has been a problem over the last several years, we recently were able to focus efforts to look at this problem with one person. I would say that with these efforts, we'll be able to hopefully maximize the agencies that we have working with us and perhaps even bring some more hospitals on board in this effort. It really is keeping people at the local community at the appropriate level of care really is important in this process. And that is a connection that we're continuing to work on. There's nothing now to request you to do. We're really doing our own homework to look at that statewide to see how to make that work most effectively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to continue on then with the next division, which is our Office of Children's Services. Christy Lawton will be joining us here. Christy is the acting director for our Office of Children's Services. Most of you are familiar with our former director, Tammy Sandoval. Tammy took a new job with the University of Alaska Anchorage last summer, and Christy stepped in to be the leader for the group. In the Office of Children's Services, we have 499 authorized full-time employees, and the entire operation for OCS is organized into five regions throughout the state with 26 field offices. The primary purpose of our Office of Children's Services is to provide protective services to children who are subject to or at risk of harm. But in addition to that, the division also manages the Infant Learning Grant Program, which provides early childhood special education services for families where young children evidence developmental delays to try to bring those children up to speed, so to speak, so that they will be able to continue through their educational process at grade level, if at all possible. We also provide grant funding to 9 child advocacy centers and are currently working with Kodiak to bring up a 10th child advocacy center in fiscal year 2012. The division provides a multitude of family support and family preservation services to improve the success of families in caring for children who otherwise might be at risk of removal. So our first effort is to try to maintain those families intact where at all possible and provide services directly to the family to enable that to occur. We are subject to periodic review by our federal partners in terms of our child protective services. We are measured against statistics that are applied throughout the nation in terms of our program performance and almost always have a program improvement plan that we are working to meet as a part of that effort. In the Office of Children's Services, I'd say the biggest challenges that we've got is in maintaining experienced staff. It's a very high stress environment. There is a lot of staff turnover as a result. And in 2009, there was a survey conducted of our OCS staffing where it was shown that over 60% of our frontline social workers had been in the position that they occupied for something less than 2 years. It doesn't mean they were all new to the division over that two-year period, but some of that staff promoted in that environment. But it's an indicator of the kind of constant turnover that we're seeing and the training that we need to have ongoing in order to keep a full complement of social workers. The most significant thing that we've done recently is not reflected in the budget, but a number of legislators participated in this conversation last year, and that was in realigning resources to actually create the Western region. This is the region now that services the Yukon-Kuskokwim area of the state, and it was as a result of attention that was paid by the Citizens Advisory Review Panel, the court system out in that region, and the legislative delegation that we decided that the best way to try to improve the service delivery in that area was to create a separate region and separate the management of that region from the rest of South Central, which is managed out of Wasilla. The Wasilla office has been experiencing increased caseload, and the division and the geographic distance was making it extraordinarily difficult to be effective in both regions without creating a separate region and some direct management. The division, however, still struggles, particularly in our rural offices, and Bethel is a primary example in acquiring good, qualified, experienced staff to serve in these rural areas.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, sir. Question to you is, have you put into the queue the review, the Citizens Review Panel for a hearing soon?
Representative Herron, that's a great question because I was just wanting to point out that we have numerous groups that come to the committee and ask for a presentation. And that's part of the reason why I wanted this overview, because organization chart, we're going to put it up there. And when we have a presentation, we'll try to identify where they fall. And just because that's a very good panel, this is no statement on the Citizens Advisory, not to diminish that at all. But just because they come into the committee and make a presentation doesn't necessarily mean that it's an emphasis on them. It's more a reflection of how committed they are to get the hearing. You know, and so if we want, it really helps us to hear from them. I mean, it's a very positive thing. This isn't negative at all. But, for example, when we get together next Tuesday, we're going to be hearing from the Suicide Prevention Council. They have a great report out. I've heard it. It's fantastic. I'm eager for the committee and for it to go on the record. But we'll identify where it falls here. Melissa was just up here, you know, and we'll put it on there to just kind of help us keep the big picture. Now, in answer to your question, yes. I'm not sure of the date, but we have agreed that the Citizens Advisory council could talk to us, and when that happens, we'll have Christy back here too, so that it's all in context as best we can do.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Curtis Sissa.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Actually, I came to the legislature because of foster care, as a foster parent and working in the field of working with parents and families. And so I've actually, over the last 13 years, seen how we've been doing. And how we've been doing isn't that great. And actually having been for about 10 years prior to that, working with the department, or with the division, actually, as a foster parent and as a worker on teams working with families, realized there were problems long before that. So this is something that's an ongoing chronic problem. And one of the things that I think is different about this than the other divisions that we have in the state is that we are the parents. We here are the parents, and the staff too. We're the parents of these children in state custody. And if, in fact, we take a child out of a home, the safest place for a child is actually in their own home. And unfortunately, what I've come to believe is the safest place for a child is in their home, not in a foster home, because there's so much turnover of those children from a foster home to foster home, and there's many, many wonderful, wonderful foster homes. There's enough that aren't so wonderful that you're putting children that are high risk, they're already in real trouble, into places that they shouldn't be in. And that actually puts them in more danger than actually even taking them out of their own home. And that's true in many cases, that some, absolutely any place is better than what they were in. So our role as parents, as a state, mean that to me, this is a priority. It is a priority because we're in a completely different place than we are with anything else in the state. We're not responsible for people's lives in anything else that we do, but here we're the parent. And so I would love to see something that we receive on a regular basis that tells us statistics that show us how we're doing. And we need to find ways to be investing in, because of our role as parents, in making sure that these kids are getting the kind of care that gives them a better future. And we did some things last year that were good. I don't know if we've made a difference with the frontline caseworkers yet, but the turnover there has been so miserable. And that's a systems problem. And we're responsible for that. And we are the first people that should be responsible for that. So getting information from you on exactly what's happening in terms of the turnover of kids, of the staff for sure, the kids, and how we're preserving their placement so that the first place they go is the last place they go out of home, and the things that we do, if we could get some kind of reporting that really shows us and helps legislators know our responsibility and make sure that we follow through. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. And I believe the question there was that your request, a request for data we can measure. Yeah. And I appreciate your passion. This is the hardest area, probably one of the hardest areas for legislators. If you're new to the newly elected, you'll get to know Christy before too long, because there's a lot of interaction, and it's a very tough area. There's no area more loaded with emotion and more evident that, you know, we have a crisis in the family, as with OCS. So I appreciate your work, too. Please proceed.
For the record, my name is Christy Lawton. I'm the Acting Director for the Office of Children's Services.
We do.
Mr. Chairman, through Representative Sisna, for the Chairman, I'd like to just comment on a lot of the things you said. First of all, we'd be happy to look at some ways that we could provide some data to you on a regular basis, and we can talk further about what that would look like. I agree with you. Children belong in their homes. That's the first place that they should be. The state makes a miserable parent. That's the truth. We don't make good parents. Our emphasis has been and will continue to be to keep children in their own homes when it's safe to do so, whenever possible. And we are making strides in that regard, particularly over the last 5 years. We're seeing improvements. We're seeing a reduction in the number of children entering foster care to begin with. And so I think that you will see through some of the data that we'll provide to you that we are making some improvements. We have a lot of work still yet to do, but we're on the right track.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there are no further questions for Christy, we're going to leapfrog through our presentation here and move to public health. Dr. Hurlbert is unable to be with us next Tuesday, so we want to make sure that you get a chance to talk to him. So Dr. Hurlbert will be joining me at the table.
While you're coming there, Dr. Hurlbert, I wanted to say that Representative Miller rejoined us. He had a previous commitment that he could not get out of. It isn't that he didn't care. He wanted to be here. He just couldn't. And then a little later here, Representative Herron in about a half hour is going to have to leave. And the same thing, it's a lot of things going on in the building. So please proceed. Okay. And welcome.
Mr. Chairman, the Division of Public Health is a large division, again, as you're learning all of our divisions are. There are 507 full-time people in the Division of Public Health. Dr. Hurlbert pulls double duty. He is the state's chief medical officer as well as being the director of the division. The operations included in the Division of Public Health are public health nursing with locations at public health centers throughout the state, vital statistics, you know, birth, death, marriage, record keeping. We operate two public health labs, one in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks. And in addition, we've got staff that provide infectious disease and epidemic prevention and control, that provide certification and licensing for numerous health facilities throughout the state, including conducting a background check unit to provide background checks on all of those health service providers who are subject to that legislation and requirement. And the division also operates the state medical examiner's office. We also coordinate the emergency services operations throughout the state through a grant program. We end up having numerous challenges in this area because the operations are so diverse, but I think that Dr. Hurlbert is a better person to talk about what some of those challenges are, so I'm going to just leave that to him.
So. Dr. Hurlbert, if you would identify yourself and go ahead and...
Thank you. My name is Ward Hurlbert. I'm the director of the Division of Public Health, the Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services. It's a privilege to be here. Mr. Chairman, would you like me just to talk about the challenges? A little bit or wait for questions?
We can wait for questions unless you, if you didn't have anything prepared. Melissa did a great job. So do we have any? Representative Herron has a question, I see. Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor. My constituent's favorite subject, medical examiner office. It's a real issue, and I would like to visit with you and how we can make some changes so it's more sensitive to the needs in rural Alaska. Sometimes a body doesn't have to come back, and the example I want to use is the medical examiner required the body to travel to Anchorage, and it was probably inappropriate. And but the family that was, you know, obviously in distress there, they didn't realize that when they signed over, when they signed the documents, that the body was going to go from the examiner to a funeral home. And if they had known that those documents said that they were going to bear the cost of those funeral services, they would have chosen to have the body returned to the village without being embalmed. And so there's, you know, in those situations, they're always difficult. But I don't want to belabor this, Mr. Chairman, as I would like to work with you on how we can make some changes to the medical examiner, because we're not going to get a one in my region. It's just that it won't work. But let's work on procedure and protocol that would be more sensitive to this very difficult situation that's going on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I, did you want to respond?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Herron. We would be very pleased to work with you on it, because it is hardest on folks from areas like the ones that, that you represent there. The policy actually is that when there is a need for a body to come in, and the number of examinations have gone up over the last two or three years from about 350, basically an Anchorage Matsu function, trying to be a statewide function, and stories like an individual with a hole in the back of the head being signed off as dying from natural causes because there was not a medical examiner involved. So we've tried to improve that, but the policy would be to bring the body in and to return the body to the family normally in the same kind of metal container that they're brought in. So sending them to a funeral home would be outside the normal policy, but it is a time of grief, of dismay, and of distress, and I think sometimes there may be miscommunications about what may be expected, but what you described would actually be an exception to what should be the policy. But I know you hear it all the time, and we would very much appreciate the chance to talk with you and maybe have you sometime when you're in Anchorage come over to the Veterans Examiner's office and see it.
I don't want to belittle this, but Mr. Chairman, is that after barking dogs, yes. Yeah, this issue of the medical examiner has been one of the most calls that we've received in the last 12 months. So look forward to it, Doctor.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We read not too long ago that as of January 1st, the state was not supporting flu shots, influenza shots to adults. Can you update us on that and where that comes in and how we're moving for preventative health, or if we are pulling back from that program?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. A little history on that. Through the influence of the late Senator Stevens, Alaska consistently received significantly more than our relative share of federal funding through the Centers for Disease Control, through CDC, for immunizations. In 2008, when there was an election, that stopped. And so we now receive less funding. We receive our fair share. We're not getting the short end of the stick. But we were privileged and advantaged to receive more funding before. So we had money to buy vaccines, not only for children, but for adults, including the flu vaccine for adults. That funding is no longer there. We still have a virtually a universal vaccine program for children that we can buy the vaccine, and the recipient just needs to pay the administration cost for the vaccine. And that's better than many states in the country. Many states have had to discontinue that. But with the loss of that federal funding, effective January 1, we are no longer able to pay for the vaccine for adults. This can have an impact. Now, influenza vaccine is not expensive. If you go to the Safeway here, it'll be about $30 for a Medicare-eligible individual. Last year, the last flu season, 2009-2010, Alaska had the best immunization rate for flu vaccine for the over 65 population for the seasonal flu of any state in the country. It was not good enough. We were about 65%, but we did better than everybody else. We're trying to redouble our efforts with the loss of this funding to keep that up. But that's the history. It was federal money that's no longer there. now for the vaccine for the adults.
Follow-up or proceed?
Thank you. And, you know, on the third bullet point under public health for chronic disease prevention and health promotion, I shared with the commissioner some of the research that has come forward on vitamin D and it being actually as effective in preventing influenza and upper respiratory diseases as vaccines. And so I don't know if you've gotten that information yet, but I would appreciate working with you on that and seeing, because it's much cheaper on a year-round basis than even a single immunization. So I would like to invite you. I think the chairman has scheduled a hearing here, and we're bringing people in from University of California, San Diego, and Creighton University in Nebraska for a hearing on some of those things on vitamin D, and one of them is on influenza, prevention. And so I hope that we can work together on that.
This is a great opportunity for me to throw something else in. Dr. Hurlburt plays another role, a very important role in my life. He's the chair of the Alaska Health Commission, and the Alaska Health Commission has been tasked with the job of advising the legislature to governor related to things just like you bring up. And we have an annual report that we're going to have it presented here also in the committee by the executive director, the director of the group, Deb Erickson. But the reason I'm throwing this in here now is I just wanted to put on the record that I have come to really respect and appreciate Dr. Hurlburt's expertise. Your resume is incredibly impressive, and your leadership skills are obvious, and thank you on the record. So, not only two hats, not only public health and the chief medical officer, but I see your role as the chair of the Alaska Health Commission very significant. So, and we are, I think where I was going with that is I've been talking with Deb about vitamin D presentation, and she's tracking this, and maybe it will be something that comes up in the Alaska Health Commission. So.
Thank you.
Yes, if I could catch here, just in case we might be moving on. I'm probably going to mess this up a little bit. The Constitution really talks about health in one simple little sentence that says, the legislature shall provide promotion and protection of public health. I think that's it. You guys are it. Your department or your division is it in terms of really following through what the Constitution says. And I think at the time it was written, it was public health nurses that were really kind of out there doing it. And can you perhaps speak to the direction that you're taking on speaking of public health nurses who are still out there, still doing some things, but that really heavy preventative health promotional emphasis. What role is the division taking on that? And do you see the division being important in continuing and increasing that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sista, thank you for the opening on that. We do think that the health promotion, the prevention efforts, public health is important. All the citizens of the state are the patients of public health, and we do have that responsibility. Public health is funded at well under 3% of total health care dollars nationwide, not just in Alaska. So it does not receive the glamour and the attention that the high-tech stuff, and I've been a clinician most of my life, that receives. But the prevention things are important. Some of the things that were so big in the history of Alaska, like tuberculosis, measles outbreak, other infectious diseases, are still with us, and we still need to keep our guard up. New diseases come along, but the chronic diseases, what I call the diseases of choice, the complications of choices that we make, are the big problem now. The biggest killer, the biggest killer in the loss of our premature deaths, loss of life, relates to tobacco. Yet we've made great strides. Alaska now, for the adolescent group, the age 14 to 17, is number 7 among the states, and that comes from almost the bottom of the list. For adults, we've come down from number 41 to number 31. For Alaska Native adults, major progress, but still a long way off. We're about 38.8% with tobacco use. I always have to say, I have to give a lot of credit to our governor. When he was in the legislature, was chair of the Senate Finance Committee, locked in a significant portion of that tobacco settlement money. CDC ranks the states in terms of the money you spend on the population for anti-tobacco efforts. There are 7 states that fund 50% or more of what CDC says should be funded. We're among those 7. We, in fact, are number 1 among all 50 states. We're not at 100%. We're much closer to 50%. We're in the 57 or so. But among all the states, the effort that we put into it in terms of the dollars spent is number 1 among all 50 states, and it is paying off because our kids are not smoking. Now, we have some new things that I think the biggest public health challenge that we have, and I'm sorry my answer is a little long, but I have some passion about it. The biggest public health challenge that we have is the complications of obesity and overweight. Those things now cost us more than the complications of tobacco. It's approaching the number of premature deaths from tobacco. CDC has said this in 2003, and they've repeated recently, that of kids born in the past decade in the United States, 1/3 are at high risk of developing diabetes. We have had about 6% of American adults have had diabetes. We're now up to about 8.3. That's going up. CDC says about 25% are pre-diabetic, which means if they're overweight or obese, they're at high risk of becoming diabetic. The economic impact of this to the total economy on the country, on our state, is unfathomable. So this is a responsibility that we have. It will take decades, just like tobacco has, to change our culture and to change the message. But absolutely, yes, as I say, thank you for your opening to give me a chance to say that. But that is our job. And to collaborate with schools, with community change agents, with others, certainly with the legislature, in addressing these things in our state and for our citizens. Thank you.
Can we at ease for just a bit here? We're going to go ahead and quit early. Let me say it again. We're on the record. We're going to go ahead and quit here shortly and come back on Tuesday, and we'll be hearing from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Ed and the Statewide Suicide Council and the Statewide Independent Living Council. I'm sorry for the repetition. I just forgot to go back on the record for the people that are listening from afar. And so anyway, did you have any final statements for today, Commissioner Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The big comment that I have is thank you very much for giving us all this time to be able to present our case. The department is near and dear to me. I think most of you that know me know that. And I think the efforts of the department are significant in the progress of this state. So we look forward to next Tuesday and winding it up for you in a concise manner. We'll be here, bells on our toes. Thank you, sir.
Any parting shots from the committee? I guess not. We gaveled out at 4:00.